All right, this is JPEG to Raw, show number 230, coming the day after tax day. Tim, you survived tax day? Tax day in the U.S. If you're in another part of the world, I don't know what your tax day is.
I barely survived. On my way home yesterday from work, my wife's like, you got an envelope here, and it was returned for postage. It was my state income tax. I forgot to put a stamp on it. So I got to the post office at 5:02 and said, here. He's like, I'm closing. I was like, just take this. He took it. So
Wait. I know this photography show won't spend a whole lot of time on this, but I do have to ask Tim this question. You mail yours in? You don't electronically file?
I do electronically file, but I had to pay, and I didn't send my accountant my checking account number for him to withdraw, or the routing number to withdraw the funds. So he already completed the federal part of it. Okay. So I just mail in the state because I had to pay them, which annoyed me.
Yeah, so I use TurboTax. Not an advertisement for TurboTax, but that's what I use. There's other people you can use. I've used TurboTax for years. This time I found that it made a mistake. You know, it generally finds the lowest tax rate that the lowest tax amount that you should pay, or the most amount you'll get back with that in mind. And I don't have a super complicated thing, but I do have a few things, and it calculated two situations it could have done. It chose the wrong one.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have known it unless I said, I wonder what happens if I do this. And it was a fairly significant difference. Thousands of dollars, just to say. So it's not a minuscule amount that it made a mistake on.
Yeah, I'm surprised at that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that issue. But I've used the same accountant for, it's got to be over 25 years now, longer than I'm married, I know that.
As an accountant, I feel I should be able to do mine. Since
yes, you should.
Not all accountants, and including me, are tax experts, but mine is fairly simple. I don't have rental property and all kind of crazy things going on that makes taxes complicated. Or a side business. If you're a photographer who has, you're doing this for a living and you're deducting part of your home, or you are, you got your business expenses and all that kind of stuff. And especially if you're getting into depreciation and things like that, your taxes can get fairly complicated. And it's imperative that you do good record keeping. But I don't have any of that kind of stuff.
I'm sure when my accountant gets my taxes, like, yes, this is an easy one. Easy money.
For a lot of them, they do. You'll be surprised how many people come in. In college, I was part of the IRS volunteer program called VITA, where we would go out to different libraries and people come in, or different community centers, whatever. People come in and we would help them finish their tax returns. And I did a ton of 1040 EZs and 1040 A's, and rarely would I have to do a 1040. And if you're not from the U.S., the 1040 EZs are basically all you're doing is taking a W-2, putting it on the report, and sending it in. I mean, it's really that easy. 1040A is just a little bit more complicated than that. And then 1040s can get extremely complex.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. That's enough for tax day.
Yeah, we already passed it, so it doesn't matter.
Already passed it. Yep. I filed mine last night at like 11 o'clock because I owed both state and federal, which I knew. But I filed mine at the last day. I already knew I was owing, so you might as well wait till the very end to file it. All right, so that's it. That's tax day. Hopefully all you guys had a decent tax day. You know, theoretically, I know, I'm going to get off this in just a second. Theoretically, if you can plan properly, you want to owe at the end of the year, because that means you have got more money throughout the year and got use of that money, and then you pay at the end. Some people like getting a big refund. That just means you gave the IRS or the state, whoever it is, a loan during the year. So it's however you want to plan it.
I think of it as a forced savings account.
Okay. Yep. That's
a Christmas club or a vacation club. You call it what you want.
I know a lot
but
of people
I,
think
I did read an article the other day, and I'll hopefully end this tax thing, that the IRS is going to change the deductions so that you're less likely to get a refund or owe at the end of the year. So they're going to change the withholding. And I don't know, is that going to be individual based or how they're going to do it? But
you didn't end it with that, because now you opened up another target. And bear with us just a little bit longer. If you're not self-employed, if you work at a company, what Tim, you're talking about, is a change in the W-4 for I think 2020, maybe 21. They're getting a lot of feedback. And your W-4 now is really, really easy, where you just basically say, I'm married and two deductions, or single and no deductions, or whatever you're choosing. What they're going to be doing going forward, and this is still in the phases of asking for feedback, is a much more complicated W-4, where basically you're almost filling out your tax return. You're going to have to tell, and this is where a lot of feedback is, you're going to have to tell the company, here's the other sources of income I have. Let's say you got dividend income or interest income.
Right, right, right.
You got to tell them that. Here's my spouse's income. Here's my typical deductions. And all that is, and your spouse will have to do that at their work if you're both employed by other people. And all that is so that they hopefully will get the right taxes withheld during the year. But we'll see. I think that a lot of people are going to have a lot of trouble telling their employers what their spouse makes. Not because they don't have the number, but because that's, you know, I don't want my employer knowing what my spouse makes. I may not want my employer knowing what other sources of income I have. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're a weekend photographer, and that's doing pretty good for you. You may not want your current boss to know that.
No, maybe not. You're right.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, that's enough of that. But speaking of other sources of income, I know I've talked about this before. This is iStock.
Yes.
I've been with iStock for a long, long time. It's got to be back when they were new. It's got to be more 10 years or so, maybe, Tim. I don't know. It's longer than when we've been doing this podcast. And
yeah,
we're going to have been doing this podcast 8 years this summer. So longer than that. And when I first got into it, I loaded these photos. I'm going to show you them right now, maybe if my mouse gets over there. These photos, I think there's like, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. I thought there was 18. Ha, I was right. 18 photos, and I've never uploaded any more at all, ever. I just stopped. And they were making, you know, me, I think somewhere in the range of 10 to 20 bucks a month is what they would make.
Right, right.
Somewhere along the line, iStock was bought out by Getty Images, and they changed some things. And because it was only making 10 to 20 bucks a month, and iStock would only let you take the money out once it reached over $100. You couldn't take that money out every month.
Okay.
I've been lax and haven't gone and asked them, hey, I'm ready to take my money out. Until recently, when I went out there to see that, I can go in and I can, you see right now, it says, Atlanta Mike, I'm actually not logged in here. I can log in. I know my login, but there's no place on here to request your money anymore. You got to go through Getty, and Getty says I don't have an account, but I can sign up to be a contributor. So I'm caught in this loop of they're still selling my stuff. I have no idea how much they've sold because I can't look at any of my reports.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to contact them multiple times. Today I finally did get a response, but I tried over a month ago to find out. And the response just was they asked me for more information. Mm-hmm. So I'm not anywhere close to getting a resolution. But I'm really interested because this first guy right here, the one with the hot dog, that one was this one on the far right was by far my biggest seller. Apparently I've seen it all over the place in Orlando.
Right.
I've seen book covers. There's a book cover. I have it upstairs somewhere. So I'm sure there's more than likely at least a couple hundred, if not more, not big money, but there's a couple hundred dollars out there that I've got to eventually get resolution here. They're still selling them. And I looked through my email because I am a hoarder. A digital hoarder. I don't delete any of my emails. They've never sent me an email saying, hey, contributor, here is the new way to get your funds. It used to be, you know, as a contributor, it was really easy. You just go on there, you go to the link, you see, hey, I got 1,500, I got 150 bucks. I want that money. So they've made it a little more difficult. And when I go into the Getty thing, and I can go in and I think you got to download some app. Anyway, anywhere I go, all the different ways I go, it wants me to sign up as a new contributor, which won't do me any good. Because right. When you sign up for a new contributor, the first thing you got to do is upload three images that they then will approve or disapprove. And until you get three images approved, you're not a contributor. I don't need to do that. I'm already an approved contributor.
Right.
And I'm really probably not going to ever contribute anymore. I just want the money of my images you're selling. You know? So I have to update
you. This shouldn't be so difficult.
It shouldn't be so difficult, but I think they make it so difficult because if I never get them my money, they get to keep the money and keep selling my images. Anyway, and I wish, like, right now I'm logged into my account that I could click on this and it should be able to tell me. Oh, there you go. That says October 9th, 2013. That's only 6 years ago. That's not right. I wonder,
I need to go back. They were all uploaded at the same time?
Yeah, well, I think that was one of my early ones that I uploaded. Look at that. They're selling that thing for $33. Holy crap. I wonder how much money I'm getting from that. I wonder how much. But it used to be able to, you can go here and it would tell you, you know, how much your, how many sales you had. And again, it says credit Atlanta Mike. And then we go back to that. Anyway, I'll update you as I hear more from Getty because iStock doesn't reply to you. It's just Getty. And I think really the only ones that have sold. This one sold here too. This one with him walking in the woods. So the, nice the two one. Hot dogs and that one have sold.
Yeah, the hot dog is the one I think you've talked about first as being sold.
Yeah, this one on the far right, that image alone has made well over $1,000 in sales on iStock. I think these two were approaching
that. Does it tell you how many downloads?
Well, right now it doesn't. I don't have any idea where to go now. It used to. You could go right on here and it would tell you all that kind of stuff. You would go to your account and look up the contributor stats and you could see all that information. But they've made it much more difficult to find. So if you were a member of iStock, now iStock by Getty Images, and you have an easy way to get there or know what I need to do now that it's not just iStock, reach out to me. In the meantime, I reached out to Getty, and I got a response, you know, not long before we started the show tonight. And so I'll reply to that after we get off and continue the process. But I'm really interested to see how much money is sitting out there.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
You might have to change your taxes.
Well,
not back to the taxes. No.
Until I get the money. Hey, buddy, I'm on a cash basis of taxes for. I haven't got the cash, so it's not my money yet. Anyway, I mean, I know penny stocks or micro stocks or whatever is not for everyone, and it's gotten a lot more competitive. I'm not sure these images would be approved by today's standards, especially the camera wise. Those were taken. I think most of those were taken with a Nikon D2H, which was a 4-megapixel camera. I don't think those will be approved today. You definitely need a higher resolution. It's just not something I'm interested in doing in the future. All right. Next article here I got, Tim. Oh, that wasn't an article. The first article I have is this. Have you seen this? This is a fly. On the inside of a Canon 70-200 lens that was rented from Lens Rentals.
So hold it. It was inside the lens, not between the body and the lens?
No, inside the lens. Inside the lens itself.
Wow. How the heck did it get in there?
So, you know, what they talked about in this article was, did it happen in the manufacturing process? That somehow in a manufacturing process a fly get in there, because that's a full-grown house fly.
Yeah.
And what Lens Rental says is doubtful, because they've been renting that lens for 15 months before this guy pointed it out. So you would think along 15 months,
right, somebody would have seen it.
Someone would have said,
"Now I'm assuming it was dead." I'm assuming it was dead.
Yes, it was dead.
Okay.
But you would
think it wasn't buzzing around inside.
No, you would think 15 months of renting this lens out, that someone along the lines would have said, "What the crap? There's a fly in the lens." And when this guy pointed out, Lens Rental said, "No, this is the first we've heard of it." But so the theory, we'll never know for sure, but the theory is is that a fly larvae somehow wiggled its way inside the image, inside the lens, and then inside the lens somehow either, I don't know how what flies and larvae need to become flies, but had enough nutrients to transform itself into a fly and then, of course, die once it became an adult. So that was interesting. So the question then the photographer had who rented it was, but what impact does it have on image quality? Have you ever done the test where you put a pencil in front of your lens?
Yes.
So you take your lens, you put a pencil in front of it, and if you stop down far enough, it really almost completely.
It's like I did that taking pictures at like a baseball game if you're behind
the fence.
The fence.
Yeah.
So right, you don't see it. It blurs it out.
Right. So if, and there's a closer image of the fly. I mean, it's a regular house fly. You're not going to be able to tell here, but if you look at this, you know, when the lens was stopped down, I think it was a 2.8 lens. When the lens is fairly stopped down, it has virtually no impact whatsoever on the image quality. Wide open, not stopped down. When it's wide open, it has almost no impact on the image quality. As you stop it down, as you get to like F13 or higher, it definitely has an impact on that. I mean, just like stuff on your sensor is going to have an impact. As you can see the little fly right there at F13. Mm-hmm. So the photographer here was talking about, I guess this photographer doesn't use lens caps because he says it slows him down too much. Maybe he's in and out of his bag a lot and doesn't want to put lens caps on there. I personally use lens caps, but I'm not moving between lenses really fast or in a fast-paced environment, so I it's not a problem for me. But you know, at first when they stopped using lens caps, he was worried that the dust and the scratches that could potentially get on there and all that kind of stuff would degrade the image quality. And I guess it depends on what you're shooting. If you're a landscape photographer and you're often shooting it at, you know, F8, F11, F13 or more, it might. But in his case, he's shooting more wide open or more wider than something like that. So to him, this proved or backed up his theory on I don't need to use lens caps. What do you think, Tim?
I use lens caps every single time, and you're right. I don't know. I mean, you bought that big rubber thing to put over your lenses. I just think in my mind, you probably don't catch anything. I've seen smudges on the front of my lens I've been taking pictures with and don't notice it 99% of the time. But then you think about you have if you have a little speck on your sensor and you're stopped down or you're at a high aperture, I guess, you see that. So you're going to capture something sooner or later that you don't want to see. Yeah. So and my point is I always have my camera. It's in my camera bag. I don't want something that's going to bounce into it when it's there inadvertently hitting it. So I'm not going to say 100% of the time I have a lens cap on there when I'm not using it, but more often than not, I have a cap on there. And if not, I have the shade.
And the same way, I like putting the lens caps on there because I feel more protected, whether I am or not. But even I know people who don't put it on either end. And for me, especially the back end of it, I'm worried that in my camera bag, it's going to get all kind of crap in the back end. I'm then going to take it and stick it on my camera, and all that crap is going to go into the body of the camera.
I think more often than not, I probably put the cap on the back end of the camera before I put the lens back on the camera.
Yeah.
I'm more likely to protect that.
Yeah, me too. So the next question he had is, what on earth would it take to get that thing out?
I don't know. Can you?
Well,
you and I couldn't.
You and I can't. But someone who has the right tools and someone has the right expertise.
The knowledge of how to
do that.
Because sometimes those things are put together with one part of it being hot, the other part cold, and put together. And then thermal expansion, they form together. Now you can't get that open.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure there are people that know, just like iFixit takes down everything. They know how to do it more than I do.
And you know, a lot of modern lenses are very high tech. There's a lot going on in there. So what it turned out to be for this lens, which is a Canon 7200, what did they say? Which version of that was it? 2.8 IS2. So, you know, it's a good camera, a good lens. I think it was an L lens, right? They didn't say. Anyway, it took over 3 hours. Let's see, it took over 3 hours to take it apart and fix it with all the proper gear and an experienced person doing it to take it apart, get the fly out, and put it back together. And there is the dead fly. It looks like, I don't know if all that junk happened during the taking apart process, right? Or that was already there, because that looks pretty dirty too.
Yeah.
And who knows? That could be little bitty fly parts as it tried to get out.
Bouncing around. He said, I am stuck in here.
But I thought that was pretty insane that they found out.
I would never thought that.
Yeah. All right.
That's an interesting one. I will say that.
Yep. Yep. All right. Next, this is going to be an opinion process. So if you're out in chat or if you're listening to this later, I love to hear your opinion, what you think. We're going to hear the opinion of these people. And that is, the quote here was, everything above 1600, ISO 1600 looks the same. Stop complaining about it. So I know right off your bat you say, obviously it's different. 1600 and 6400 is obviously different.
You would think. They go up to like, what's 128,000 now, some cameras?
No matter what. And I don't know if this article, as I read through it, I don't think it meant all the way up to the insane levels. I think that from what I was looking at, they were talking about between 1600 and 6400. And depending on your camera, you know, it's going to perform better or worse at those higher ISOs. But the question is, do you think, and they're talking about not necessarily for viewing on your computer at, you know, 100% and all that kind of stuff, but like in printing, or if you're mm-hmm. putting it out for the web where you're reducing the size, what is your thoughts as far as the image, you know, quality, the noise quality between 1600, let's say 6400? How often do you shoot at those higher levels?
You know, I think this is definitely going to come to the camera. I think my camera probably maxes out at 6400, being it's probably about 8 years old, the body now. I rarely ever take it 6400, but you know, you think of it, if you're going to shoot at 6400 and get the shot versus 1600 and now it's going to be blurry or it's no good, I probably would do it. And I know I have done it to get a shot off, but and half the time I don't print them anyway. So, I mean, I know the article talked about printing it up to a larger size and whether somebody's gonna to stick their nose in up against it to say, oh, look, there's blotches in there. This was shot at 6400. Nobody does that because you're looking at it from several feet away anyway.
Yeah, and if you look at these images at this size, because if you're using a higher megapixel camera, you know, 20 megapixel, 30 megapixel, 50 megapixel, and you're shrinking them down to this size, you're not going to see a huge difference. If you mm-hmm. expose correctly and everything else is all right, you're not going to see a huge difference between 1600 and 6400 at these sizes. And maybe at the print sizes. And the other comment was, hey, if you print a large print, like let's say, I don't know how well you can see this one back here behind me. That was shot with a D2H, a 4 megapixel camera. And it's a 20x30 right. image. So if you got up close to it, you would say, yeah, that 4 megapixel camera, you probably, stretched it a little bit further than what, you know, it was meant for. But you're not going to look at the thing this close. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to stand back and look at it from a normal viewing distance. And from that normal viewing distance,
and I'm
you would never... Yeah.
Right. I'm about 800 miles from that picture right now.
you would never know that was from a D2H 4 megapixel camera if you viewed it from a normal viewing distance. So I know in that case, with those higher ISOs, if you're viewing it up to a certain print size, if you're viewing it from a normal viewing distance, you may not notice that much of a difference. Now, I shoot a lot of sports. And, you know, even outside sports, the early morning games, soccer games, the late afternoon soccer games, the indoor basketball games, the lighting typically stinks. And you talked about your camera only goes up 6,400.
Yeah, I think 6,400 is.
And in those environments, I'm usually starting to shoot at 6,400 and having to go even higher if I have to. Now, mine is a crop sensor. It's a Nikon D500. It's probably the best I've owned as far as noise goes with a crop sensor. Mm-hmm. But at those, at 6,400 ISO, you definitely start to lose some sharpness in the image, and you notice the noise. I mean, it's still there. But, you know, like you said, I can't go lower because I'm already wide open with the lens, a 2.8 lens. I'm already wide open.
Right.
I need that reach of that 70 to 200 or mm-hmm. maybe even longer, my Sigma 120 to 300. So I can't go to an 85 millimeter 1.8 and go even more wide open. So if I go too low with the shutter speed, I end up with blurry images, and those are useless for the most part. Mm-hmm. So I need to be able to stop the action, the main action. And to do that, I have no choice. I have to up the ISO. So it's either you don't get the shot or you get the shot with the noise. So in that environment, every photographer who's there shooting is having to deal with it because there's no strobe lights in these elementary school gyms or high school gyms, at least where I'm shooting. And you're not allowed to put a flash on them, you know, flash the people in the face. And you're definitely not going to bounce it off the ceiling. So you have to do what you have to do with that. So I think in what I'm seeing and when I put it online and all that kind of stuff, I do see a difference between 1600 and 6400 and especially 12,800. I don't do enough printing to say what I think one way or the other. AS, hello AS. I'm not sure who AS is. I think it depends. This person says out in chat, I think it depends on if it's properly exposed. That is key. If you underexposed and had high ISO and didn't have to bump it in post, it gets way worse. Right. Says, I think it depends on if it's properly exposed at those ISOs or if exposure is raised in post. Yeah, exactly what I said. I mean, if you have to do it in post, it's awful. Now, I will say one thing that's gotten way better with my Nikon line. If you go back to the Nikon D2X, which I have sitting behind me, it was mm-hmm. converted to infrared. Back in the day of the Nikon D2X to now with my Nikon D500, shooting at those higher ISOs, the noise definitely has gotten better. But the other thing that's gotten better is how it retains colors. Because back in the D2X days, when you started bumping up the ISO, the color fidelity, you started to really lose the color fidelity mm-hmm. and it would really fall apart. Where I think that today's, it's Amber. Hello, Amber. Today's cameras do a much better job of holding that color, even up to those higher ISOs.
Yeah, I think if I ever get a, well, not if I ever, when I do get a different camera, it'd probably be different for me, but I rarely shoot over 3,200 because the pictures are, it is noticeable in that, but that's an older camera. I mean, you think going back 15 years ago, what cameras looked like in...
It depends on what you shoot.
They keep getting better. So 6,400 now is probably nothing on a new camera. I mean, I know.
I think it's still something. I think it's still.
I think we talked about it the last time. I took pictures with my Pixel 3 up in Albany at the state capitol from my hotel room. I put it on night shot, put it up against the window, and I got a better picture out of my phone than it would probably take me 15 minutes to get that same picture out of my camera.
Yeah, well, something AD on the last time we did a photo review show, and we were gonna do one Sunday, by the way, but I gotta tell you, I could not sit here and even look at my computer Sunday because my neck was hurting so much. I was laid up, so I had to cancel. But we will be doing one shortly. The last one we did though, AD showed a picture that he took with his phone, which I think is a Google Pixel, if I'm not mistaken. That he took with his phone out in like the middle of the night. It was like 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. 2 a.m. And it was, I never guessed it. I thought it was like at sunset or sunrise or something like that.
Right.
But it used pixel shift technology. So as you know.
Right, exactly.
As you're holding it here, I can't hold this perfectly straight. There's a slight amount of movement in my phone. And it was using technology where it's taking a whole bunch of photos and getting that pixel shift, then mm-hmm. combining them into one image. You know, that may be a technology they can bring into the to the mirrorless cameras, probably more so than the DSLRs, but into the mirrorless cameras that can help build sharpness or high resolution images or something like that, that could be very helpful. And then maybe your ISO 6400 is really improved.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends on what you shoot. Like Gary says, he never goes above 1600. So if the subjects you're shooting, you know, don't require that, it's not a big deal. All right. All right. So up next, I had two. We're going to go through three things that are semi-related.
Okay.
And that is a friend, AD, who is co-host with me with the Photo Review Show. You know, he has done a lot of work with Skylum? Is that who they are? Mm-hmm. S-K-Y-L-E. Skylum. Who now has Luminar and has Aurora and has some other stuff. And they now have a product called Luminar Flex, which is a plugin for a Lightroom and Photoshop, where you can get some of the benefits of Luminar right there inside of your Lightroom or something. It's just going to be another plugin where you can do those things in there. So if you're a Luminar fan but still like to use Photoshop or still like to use Lightroom, you now have an option where you can use them together and do that.
Wow, I love those before and afters. That mountain, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we got a little slider here. So they have what they call the AI tech, where it's doing a lot of this stuff on its own. And then you can dial it down or dial it up from there. So it's more of a starting point, not intended necessarily to be, hey, press this button and it'll do everything for you. Because I think a lot of photographers who are doing editing, you know, want to have their own personal touch to it. So not just, mm-hmm. let me press a button and you figure everything out for me. But, you know, and Luminar, and now we're not going to do a full review here of Luminar, but at least not yet. But if you're interested in that, there is now the plugin. Along with that same thing, now Luminar 3 has come out, and I know they've talked a lot about they're going to eventually come out with the digital asset management. If you're a Lightroom fan, you're able to have that digital asset management where basically you can tag things and put them in folders and manage that, all your images inside of Lightroom. So, you know, mm-hmm. you can search and say, I want to see all the photos I've taken of soccer games or however you've organized and tagged your stuff. Well, Luminar now has that added into Luminar with Luminar 3. I have Luminar 2018, I think is the last version. So it would be an update for me to move to Luminar 3. I'm not sure why they've dropped the naming culture and gone to 3 versus 19.
Right.
So I don't know that. Where's that mountain? Is that mountain from Game of Thrones, which is in... I don't know how many of you watch Game of Thrones Sunday night, but that looks like the mountain that's in Iceland that they use in Game of Thrones, because they know they film part of Game of Thrones in Iceland. Anybody in chat know if that's what that is? It doesn't say here, does it? I think it is.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. So I will tell you that Skylum has reached out to me, and they want to have what they call a partnership, which I think basically is they give maybe both of us, Tim, a free copy. And which AD says, if you own Luminar 2018, you download Luminar Flex and use Luminar 2018 info to register for it for free. So you get it for free. Along with this partnership, they will, and I'm doing it in quotes because we're not partners. It's... Yeah, that's not what it is. They will give us this.
That would be another income stream that you have through taxes.
They will give us this for free, Tim. Although I may be able to get it for free already since I'm a Luminar 2018 person.
Yeah, I might be too then.
And why would any of you guys care if I get free crap? Is because they're going to give us a discount code that we can offer up to all of you guys. So if you're interested in buying it, maybe hold off just a little bit more and we may be able to get you a discount code. And along with that, we would need to use a little bit and then do a some type of review in there. If AD's up for it, I'd like to bring him on, because whatever review we're going to do, he's going to do better. So we need him there with us, mm-hmm. if that. But I like having some competitors. If you don't like the subscription model, and you want some other choice besides Adobe, and I personally like Lightroom, so I'm not necessarily looking to leave, but I know a lot of people don't like the subscription model, and something like Luminar, and there's other people too, but something like Luminar is a thing where you can buy it and then upgrade whenever you want to and not have to pay every month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reasonably priced. Where's the price? Let's go to buy now.
$59.69 and $139, I think it was.
$70 for the basic?
The basic is $59. I show $59. Luminar Flex. Oh, hold on.
I'm on Luminar, just regular thing.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, you got multiple choices there, what all you want. I have used Aurora, which is like the competitor mm-hmm. to Photomatics. I do like it. I'm probably going to use Aurora, which is from Luminar, for all my HDR images.
Yeah, I can't remember the last versus Photomatics.
Which is versus Photomatics. I think I've moved off of Photomatics for that. So we'll be coming back at a future date with some more information on that, assuming we work that out. But very interesting updates are doing. What I've seen, and I'm going to have to hold final judgment, what I've seen of the digital asset management, and this is, think of this as version one, it only gets better from here. What I've seen is it does have some features, some things in it that may be a little bit better than Lightroom, but on the whole, I still like Lightroom better.
Oh, AD's out there.
I don't know what AD likes. You know, I don't know which way he likes better.
You know what I think it is, though? I think it's, I'm used to Lightroom. I think that's, my fear is trying to learn something new. I'm so invested into Lightroom now. For me, I think that's what it really came down to. I do like it, but
that is true. That is true. As you know, we get into preference because for me, Lightroom, I got the 15-day, 30-day trial, whatever it was, and I know halfway through whatever that trial was, I was ready to give it up. I hated it, but mm-hmm. something happened in the second half of that trial where I kept using it, and I was like, all right, now I really like it. I get it. I like it. And I do that. Maybe it's just me. I'm more stuck in the mud. It takes me a little bit longer to make that conversion. So I think it's going to need me to spend some time with it. And what I'll probably do is take my last basketball shoot, you know, put that in there. I go out and shoot maybe 300 images at a basketball game, put them in there and see, this is my mm-hmm. typical use case. I know how to do it in Lightroom. How am I going to do it here?
Right.
And see what I get. And AD says, if you're on a Mac, Luminar with digital asset management is better. Don't bother if you're on a PC. It's not ready for public consumption. So hopefully they'll come out with an update that addresses the issues that AD is saying. And because if it's good on a Mac, hopefully whatever made it good on a Mac, they'll figure out why it's not on a PC and fix that. All right. Another one that AD clued me in on. And we're going to show this guy's stuff, even though they cheated on our name and took the JPEG to RAW and made a product out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's our name, Tim. Mm-hmm. But they made a product called JPEG to RAW. We've gone over it in the past.
Yeah.
I'm actually looking. I'm going to have to go out and find it now because you look like you're confused.
No, I forgot about that. We talked about it a while ago.
Where is it?
Yeah. All I see is our podcast.
Good. Good. You don't see their stuff. And I'm not necessarily against them, but here he goes. This is Topaz's Edit JPEG.
That's right, yes.
As if you shot RAW. And it's called JPEG TO RAW. We own JPEG TO RAW anyway. So they can't go get that.com. We own that.com. So they can't go get that website. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Gigapixel AI, Topaz Gigapixel AI. AD showed me some real life images that he took and used with this. So we'll look at some of the ads they're doing here. But some real life images that he did with this. And the difference is really incredible. He really did a good job with it. So if you're taking images and you're blowing them up, you need to blow them up for whatever purpose. And the process you're using in Photoshop or Lightroom, whatever you're doing, is not doing very good with it. From what I've seen for this product, it does fairly good with it. We'll play. You're not going to hear sound, because I don't know if they have copyrighted crap in it. But we'll just play this as we talk. And I think at some point we're going to have AD come on and show us maybe something he's done with this, so we can see how much better
enlarge
it is with real
images
life
images. By 600%.
Yes.
So who needs that 30 megapixel camera?
Well, so let's say that you, I know my mom does this a lot because she can't get close enough to the birds. She crops in pretty heavily. So let's say she got this great shot of whatever bird and she needed to crop in more than she should have. And but she wants to print it now. Using something like this may help her get to a, you know, a print quality that's pretty good.
Man, how does it do that?
I don't know. It does a really good job.
So I remember when my father and I used to watch, was it it was Trick Photography. My father always mentions Trick Photography. You don't know what to believe is real anymore. And, well, I mean, these are real pictures, just super enhanced. And it makes me think of like when you watch CSI or any of those crime TV shows, they zoom in more and enhance it, and it's like done instantly. Yeah, it's not how it works. Maybe
no,
it is.
that technology, I think, that's just TV crap.
Yes.
But we may be getting closer to that now with some of this stuff. This is the advertisement stuff that they're doing. But I would tell you that what AD showed me was pretty good. What resolution is this thing? Video? No, it says HD. Because it doesn't look that HD. And he's out in chat, so if he has any comments to say about it. But this, I don't have a big need for blowing up. And I'm not just looking to spend money, especially after paying my taxes. but, man, I would love to have a copy of this and play with it. So maybe AD will come on. The original instance of that was Blade Runner. Oh, so AD is referring back to the blowing up. He says the original instance of that was Blade Runner, where Deckard was zooming in on a photo.
But see, I could use this in certain instances. I could think about enhancing, and you think about, like, I take pictures of my son playing soccer. Not that I've done that recently, but and he's in net, so he's usually on the far side of the field. Even if I zoom in, sometimes I don't get close in on him. So if you could zoom in 600 times on him and have a clear picture, that might be very beneficial. So now I'm not constantly on top of him to take that picture.
What I'd be interested in, maybe AD, if you ever come on and show us this product, is there other use cases for it? So have you ever taken a large, let's just say you resize it for the web. You take an image, you resize it for the web. A lot of those issues you had with sharpness, with noise, with all that kind of stuff, and you can, by the way, you can see here, you batch process these. But a lot of those issues you have with noise and sharpness improve as you take that 20, 50 megapixel image and make it web size.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at somebody who's posted a photo of their basketball game, you go, dang, look how he shot that thing at ISO 12,800 and there's almost no noise.
Right.
Well, you're looking at
72 DPI.
Yeah. You're looking at that small image online and you look comparing that to yours that you're editing at 100% and going, why can't I get that? So my question is, if you took an image that let's say it was as good as you can get with your camera, but it still had some sharpness issues because of higher noise, and you blew it up, what does the AI do with that? Does it make the noise and the sharpness worse? Does it somehow improve it? And then if you take that blow-up image and shrink it back down, does it make any improvements? Because I know some photographers used to talk in the past about they would do that as part of their process. Blow it up,
right.
Do the editing for the noise and sharpness, shrink it back down, and then do some more editing. And they claimed that would result in a better ending image. So AD says, even more outstanding to me are there AID noise and AI sharpen. So I need to go get that. We are a Topaz affiliate. I don't think I've said that in years, so we get this much in sales. I don't even think we have a link. I don't think we have a link on a site anymore, which means we get that much in sales. But man, I like what they're doing, and I need to update my. I think I did recently, but I need to update that some of their product. Oh, I know which one I used. Don't they have the clipping one?
Oh my god! Yeah, I think some. We had some. I mean, that. Was it Remesh that we used that I really really liked? Had a couple of really interesting ones that he showed. Remember one where it took out the emblem off a car.
Yeah, I think it was Remask. Where is that one?
Yeah, it might be
Is that JPEG to RAW thing? I think they should cut us a commission.
Don't think it's going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. Where is Remask? Because that's the one I think I updated because I needed to use it for recently. It's not even listed here. And I thought that thing was really good. Am I just missing it?
Digital frame or edges. Low. They rename it. JPEG to RAW.
Gigapixel.
Motion blur. Position.
Dehaze.
Not reduce. Not that. Resharpen. Simplify is the one that he had talked about that time also. Texture. Topaz clean. Topaz denoise.
He says it's including
Topaz. Remask at the bottom left. It's a second from the bottom. The girl right there. That's it.
Is that it?
Was that the one that we used where he pulled the dog out or something?
I think it is. Yeah, this is the one I updated because I needed to crop something out of something else. It was fairly complicated to crop it out. This with all the little flowers and everything.
Yeah, I've used this multiple times. I haven't used it in a while, but using this made my life so much easier.
Yeah. So,
but sadly, every time I use it, I have to go to YouTube to relearn how to use it.
Because you use it so seldom. So Andy says it's part of the studio version now. But man, yeah, I need to get some of these. Well, what all is in studio? See, Topaz Studio, because I was able to update my Topaz Studio for free.
Yeah, I thought we had it. I thought when we bought it, it was lifetime, and that was half the reason I bought it. So you are signed in, my products.
Yeah.
Let's see what it says.
Does it tell us what products are in here?
Purchased plugins, Topaz Classic Bundle 10, purchased Studio Pro adjustments, abstraction, channel mix, edges, precision detail, quad tone. Pro adjustments. I wonder. It says claim product. Claim products.
Anyway, I don't know what all is in there because I think this is the Extend Topaz Studio with professional images.
Topaz Studio is currently running, open and running. Select help. Check for adjustment updates from Topaz Studio application. It will synchronize purchases from your account to your application. So after your purchase, will be made available for free.
Yeah, so some of these products we're talking about, I know the Gigapixel and AD said the AI denoise and AI sharpen may be additional purchases. I definitely want to check out the denoise because that's an issue I deal with in a lot of my shooting. And to tell you the truth, I'm not a big fan of the way Lightroom does it. I don't think Lightroom does a great job with noise at the higher noise levels.
So I just opened Topaz Studio and it says updates available. Do you want to install the updates? So I will do that later. See what it gives me.
All right. So I need to get back into that and find out what our affiliate link is too. All right. So that is the software news we had. So before we go to this last article, I got a question for you, Tim.
Shoot.
Have you ever heard of a person named, and if you're out in chat and you know this, you can go ahead and say it too. Person named Katie Bowman.
I don't know. Should I know the name?
You should. Katie Bowman.
Sounds familiar, but.
All right. Who in chat, don't go to Google and look it up. So don't cheat. Who in chat knows the name Katie Bowman? Uh-oh. This will be our closing story. We're going to give them a second to answer if you wanted.
If you're
listening to us on audio and wonder what's the pause, we're getting everybody a minute
to answer
without going to Google. If you go to Google, I won't know if you did, but you'll cheat. So Gary says, not me. He doesn't know who Katie Bowman is. If you don't know, go ahead and say don't know. Amber, who is Katie Bowman? 80's got to know this. Somebody's going to look it up on Google and then say they know. All right. I guess that's enough time for everybody to have said whether they know or not. And they're probably looking it up on Google. So Katie Bowman, huh?
No.
I thought you just looked it up. You're going to tell
me. No.
Katie Bowman is one of the scientists and probably the most popular scientist on the team, as far as what we've heard of. She
a game player.
She's a game player. This TED Talk is from before, you know, from a few years back, a couple years back, whatever it is. Katie Bowman is one of the scientists that worked on the recent photo of the black hole. Something that up until they took this photo, and they're not going to show the photo here because at this time they were just starting the project. Something that until they took this photo, they thought was, or the scientists thought was impossible to photograph. They photographed the impossible thing to photograph. And this black hole that they did ultimately photograph, and that's as Katie giving a TED Talk, I will pause it there, is this image here. You might have seen it on the news. You might have seen it posted somewhere. It is a photo of a black hole, so it's not going to be like, mm-hmm. you know, what you would see in the comics.
I looked at the picture several times, but I didn't.
And it is incredible what they had to do to get this photo. So this black hole, which is massive where it's at, they gave a reference to it being the size of a grapefruit on our moon. So if you took a grapefruit and stuck it on our moon, this is what the size of this black hole is from where we are. So to also let you know that the a grapefruit on our moon, if you put a grapefruit on our moon, there is nothing we currently have on Earth that could zoom in enough where you'd be able to see the grapefruit. The largest telescope we have here on Earth does not have the resolution to come anywhere near
right.
seeing a grapefruit. I think that I saw a stat that said this: the square that it would create, or the circle, whatever it is, that would create, that they could fit like 8,000 grapefruits or 8 million, whatever.
Right.
I think that's a big difference, but a lot of grapefruits.
A whole lot.
A lot of grapefruits in that space before the telescope could see it. So how did they possibly get a photo of a black hole? And it is incredibly interesting. They used, I think it was, what was it, 8 different? Oh, they determined, you know, what size telescope would you need to photograph this black hole? Because they had an idea of where it was based on what was right. happening there. So what size telescope would they need to actually do that? And they did the math, because these people are insanely smart, and figured out what kind of, you know, thing they would need. And they determined they would need a telescope the size of the planet Earth.
Oh, my God.
Yes. So obviously we can't build a telescope.
We're not manufacturing that.
We can't build one that size. So, but what they could do, and I'm looking for the graphic. That's why I switched off. What they could do is they could take the different satellites, different telescopes from around, I think it's in her thing. Maybe it's this. Nah, I'm not going to be able to tell you that. But there's like 8 different telescopes around the planet, okay? And they use that to take photos of the – I'm trying to find this graphic for you. Okay, here we go. They use these telescopes, and I think each one of those blue dots you see in the thing, mm-hmm. so maybe it's more than 8, represents the photo that telescope would take. Okay, so as you can see, if you look at the square, there's a whole lot of stuff that's missing. There's what, I don't know how many dots that is, but it's probably less than 20. 20 little dots around this big thing with lots of blank space. So how on earth can they get a photo with all that stuff missing? So fortunately, the Earth is spinning. So as the Earth spins, those dots start filling in holes. They start moving and filling in holes. But they had to synchronize all this stuff. And then, so they used something called a hydrogen master atomic clock, which, and you can see there, it starts to fill in some of the holes with that. And this atomic clock loses, this is how accurate it is, loses about 1 second every 100 million years.
Yep.
So it's fairly accurate. And you need that because you're taking all these different telescopes are taking images, and they need to take all those images because it's taken quite a few images and put them together with timestamps knowing what part that you've taken. Mm-hmm. So they did that, and ultimately they were storing all these things on an image, and where Katie came in, because her expertise is, and what, I'm not going to know what her expertise is, but she was on the side of doing the programming and taking all these images and figuring out, do they have an image? Do they have an image of a black hole? What do they have? Piecing that all together. They had to put that stuff on, let's see, what was it? 5 petabytes of, was that right? Yeah, 5 petabytes of storage.
So what? It's gigabytes. Then what? It's not petabytes. Terabytes.
Yeah, after then terabytes, then it's petabytes.
Then petabytes. Okay. Jeez.
Yeah.
It's a couple of hard drives.
Yeah, and I think it's over 200 scientists that were working on this thing. So they, it doesn't say how many images they took, but it's they say it in how much time it was. And so Katie and her team had to develop the algorithms to take this 5 petabytes of data and produce an image from it. The 5 petabytes of data is so much, as you see. I don't think this is all the hard drives. This is just some of the hard drives that they had there. They were needing to get it to different teams of these 200 scientists that are working on this so that, you know, multiple people can be working on it. And because 5 petabytes is so much data, it was faster to physically fly it to each place than it was to upload it.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't upload that. So you could stick it on a plane, fly it to Germany, have Germany do whatever they needed to with it, stick it on a plane, fly it to Australia, have them do whatever want to, faster than you can upload it. Just Jeez. Insane. And all that, you come up with the image of the black hole, and it's not going to be there. It's here. And they even got multiple dates with it where you can see it moving.
I remember reading about it and I was amazed by it, but I did not know her name. So.
Yeah. So I don't, maybe those dots weren't representing all. Every dot may not have represented one, because this looks like a lot less. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 maybe telescopes. 8. See, it says 8.
And this changed somewhere. My preconceived notion that you couldn't photograph a black hole because it sucked everything.
I didn't have a notion one way or the other. It sucks light in there.
It sucks light, so you couldn't get a picture of it, is what I was always told.
Well, I would think, though, couldn't you? And I think that's what this shows. I guess my non-scientific knowledge
wrong. That's why
is
I'm
you would see the light being sucked in.
Yes.
And that's what I think is happening here. You're seeing
all
the
gases being sucked into it, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that
was. Thankfully, it's pretty far away from us.
Yeah, I see. Figuring in trips to and from the airport and the flight itself, it took around 50,400 seconds to move the data. With the best internet connections that are currently measured in a few gigabytes per second, shipping those drives from Hawaii to MIT works out to 14 gigabytes per second, which is 112 gigabytes per second. I don't, what is that? No. I don't know what they're talking about there. It's 1,000 pounds of hard drives. Wow. Anyway, I thought that was a pretty cool story. With some, you know, ultimately they took a photo of a black hole.
Oh God. Yeah.
With some incredible scientific stuff that went on behind it. So if you're interested, you know, take a look at it and read about it. And if you're interested in science, it's definitely even more appealing is what they achieved there, what all these people did to get there. Because it's you know, it's a little more complicated than stitching together your panorama.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit more.
And it's not a matter of, well, yeah, it's more complicated, Mike, because they had more images.
You know, there's some other complications there, too. Anybody could do it,
you know
who could do it?
Who?
Don Kamarachka.
Yep. Don Kamarachka.
He could have done that.
So speaking of that, we're going to head out into the post show, and I got a Don Kamarachka update. Not much, but just wait for the post show. We'll hang out for a few minutes, and then I need to get packing for my trip starting tomorrow. All right, everybody, thanks for coming out. We'll see you next show. Good night, everybody.